K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Dick, maybe I didn't explain myself clearly enough. On 40 meters, the SWR is less than 1.2 to 1 in the SSB portion of the band. I haven't operated on CW 40 meters yet, so I really don't know. I only suspect that the performance on 40 meters is not as good as 20 through 10. So the SWR is good, but I think the mid could be something also on the roof preventing the antenna from radiating the best way. Go ahead.
When you say you're getting a good standing wave ratio on 40 meters, on the sideband portion of the band, is that the remaining standing wave ratio after your antenna tuner does its work, or are you saying the antenna itself, the barefoot antenna on 40 meters, sideband portion of the band is giving you a good visuar, but other portions of the band, like the CW portion, you're not happy with it? I'm not quite sure what you're saying there. And it sounds like you're saying that you believe you're not getting full performance out of 40 meters, obvious by the QSOs you're getting. Back to you for clarification on that, Dave. KG2RY, K2RIW.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Yeah, I think it's like that. You know, on 20 meters, you know, I get really good signal reports. Somehow the QSOs are easier to make. Maybe there's something going on with sunspots on 40, but there should be some times when 40 meters is wide open and you can make lots of contacts. And maybe I should listen more on 40 and see what I can do. I don't know what else to say. I think that, there was a DX contest a few months ago, and I was able to work like maybe 100 DX stations in a row on 40 meters, and I couldn't believe it. And say, you know, maybe I ought to give it more of a chance. Go ahead.
Yeah, the hard thing to recognize is whether or not you're getting full performance on 40 meters. When the band is in very good shape, a wet noodle will give you good performance, so it's kind of hard to tell. And I guess the only way you could make a good comparison is if you had somebody in your borough of New York City live near you, and the two of you are operating the same contest on 40 meters and compare scores. So to know whether or not you're getting low performance as opposed to, I think I should be making more QSOs during this sunspot cycle, that's a tough one to analyze, to judge. Am I getting low performance? Just to give you a wild example, if an antenna is giving you low performance, there's only about three ways it can do it. Let me drop. High standing wave ratio, and there's various ways you confirm that. So of the power you're putting into it, it's reflecting an awful lot of it back down the transmission line. The only other way it could have low performance is because the altitude above the ground and the terrain you've got around it, in other words, local buildings and water towers and things like that are giving you not much visibility to the low angle signals out to the horizon on the ionosphere. The only other way it could be low in performance is because it's got internal loss. If you could borrow somebody's thermal imaging camera, you run a couple of hundred watts into the antenna, key down for a couple of minutes, and at nighttime you look at the antenna with a thermal imaging camera. If it's low in performance because it's taking your RF energy and burning it up as heat, well, something's got to get hot, and a thermal imaging camera will show that to you. I'll admit that's a long shot. Not very many of us have ever used that, but it's something worth considering. So by the laws of conservation of energy, there's only a couple of mechanisms by which the antenna can be low in performance. Some of those are confirmable, but the blockage to the horizon because of your terrain and reflection off the ground giving you an undesirable reflection out to the horizon, that's a tough one to confirm. Over to you, Dave, K2RW in the TechNet.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Well, you know, you're familiar with, you know, how fan dipoles are built. Basically, the wires in rows, you know, so they're pretty much in the same place. But would you say that 20 meters, you know, requires less height, say, than 40 meters? Why 20 meters through 10 performs better than 40? And I know there's a lot of metal up on the roof anyway, and we tried to remove any metal or antenna material that could be, interfering with the performance of the 40-meter antenna. But it seems to work better now, but I'm still, I spend a lot less time there, so... I don't know what else to say. Dick, thank you very much for answering my question. K2RIW from KG2RY.
If the main effect of your antenna on the various bands is due to ground reflection, the number of wavelengths the antenna is off the ground determines by the signal reflecting off that ground, you know, a couple hundred feet out in front of the antenna. That determines the angle of elevation of peak signal. So as you go to the higher bands, the same number of feet off the ground is a greater number of wavelengths. Therefore, you tend to get better low-angle radiation on the higher bands. When you come down to 40 meters, where your same number of feet above the ground is nowhere near as many wavelengths, you're going to get closer to a near vertical incident sky wave type signal. You're going to be squirting a lot of the signal almost straight up as opposed to out to the horizon. There's a slim possibility that the metal girders of the building, the wiring of the building and whatever, just happens to have a resonance at 40 meters that can be giving you an other effect other than the ground reflection way down at street level, if you know what I mean. So how you would confirm that? I did an experiment. Let me drop it. I'll warn you, this is a long shot, but I built a circuit that put out very brief pulses, and with those very brief pulses and looking at the echoes, I was building an extremely short-range radar, so to speak, and this was built on a cart of equipment that I could wheel around the building. So in the building, we wanted to know how well we could propagate signals between offices, between floors of a building, and I built this a cart of equipment that built very brief, that created very brief pulses, and we looked at the echoes of the building as I wheeled this equipment around the building. In theory, you could do something like that to find out where are the echoing devices in your particular building. Is it the girders? Is it the wiring? Is it the plumbing? And so on. But that's a long shot. That's a science experiment to dream about, but I don't think you want to really carry that out. But I did something like that, and the results were kind of exciting. How long does the building ring at these individual frequencies? There were certain frequencies where the building I was testing, it was a three-story building with about, I think it had 1,500 square feet of area. There were certain frequencies where the building would literally ring like a bell for brief pulses of RF energy. Back to you for any comments on this one, Dave. I know this is a long one. KG2RY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW from KG2RY. Yeah. Well, you know, I've tried a lot of different things to improve the performance of my radio as it relates to antenna connections and other things. I set up a bunch of different... I use some kind of a ways to improve the grounding system since I live in an apartment building. You know, I tried to figure out a way to eliminate the distance between the radio and the actual earth ground, which is probably somewhere below the surface of the ground, past the basement. And if it's a hot water pipe, you know, there's a lot of distance. but I did some work about eliminating noise. I was able to eliminate noise by improving the ground and then using a phase noise eliminator signal enhancer, and improve the performance of RF and RFI with chokes and ferrite cores, and it seems to work okay now. I can't complain. I guess maybe my radio is pretty elementary for most people, and probably I spent about the least I could possibly spend on it, so I think I got the most for my money. And isn't super high-tech, but it makes good contacts. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW from KG2RY.
There are many ham radio operators who believe that a good RF ground is required for the antenna to work well. Most of the time, I disagree with that. If the antenna you're using is a balanced structure, like a dipole being properly fed with the right kind of a balancing device, that antenna could be in the hand of an astronaut that's in space, floating behind the International Space Station, and he is 200 miles, 300 miles above the Earth, and that could give very good performance. So most antennas do not require a ground. Single-ended antennas, like an in-fed ZEP, yes, it does require kind of a ground, but balanced antennas don't require ground. So grounding is required for human safety, for electrocution-type safety, but radio-wise, in many cases, grounding is not required, and that's a highly misunderstood area. You'd be amazed how many people believe that if you don't have a good RF ground, that your antenna is not going to work well. In my opinion, it's not required for a fully balanced antenna. I know that Roy has got a chat room question, so let's go over to that one. AC2GS, K2RIW with the chat room question. You got it, Roy.
Question from KD2ACC. The question is, has anyone ever heard of a device manufactured by Rob Schwartz? What does it do? He's trying to align a Marconi CF2300 and it requires, is it required a piece of gear to align on my... So there's the question.
An hour before the technet, you were on earlier tonight, Roy, and you were dead full quiet in the machine. You sounded beautiful. On that last transmission, you were dropping out 50% of the time. Signal was quite weak, quite noisy, and completely dropping out. So the propagation is changing right now tonight. And so I didn't get the question. So please repeat the question. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I want to transmit my signal and make sure that you're getting it. If not, I'll put my over thrusters on. Is this okay at this point?
You dropped out 25% of the time on three occasions during that last transmission, Roy. Go ahead.
Hey, how? I'm blasting you now, hopefully. Does that work at all?
Look like you're very steady right now, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, we'll give it a try and see how things work out. K2ADC asked the question, has anyone ever heard of a polyscope? It was a device manufactured by Rodenschwartz. What does it do? He's trying to align a TF2300A deviation meter, and he says it's a required piece of gear to be used to align his harmonic generator.
Polyscope by Rodenschwartz. That's a new one on me. Rodenschwartz makes some beautiful test equipment. I mean, they make a vector network analyzer that is, in my opinion, the world's best. Vector network analyzers always require a periodic calibration, and there's something magic about the Rodenschwartz vector network analyzers I've ever used that they hold their calibration for a year, whereas other vector network analyzers only hold their calibration for a fraction of an hour. So polyscope, the word suggests that it does multiple things. Vector network analyzing is my guess, or spectrum analyzing is another guess, where if you're looking at harmonic content, if you're trying to find out how well your frequency multiplier is working, something like a spectrum analyzer would be required. And maybe it also does some of the functions for a service monitor type thing. So I think we could probably Google Rodenschwarz and Google polyscope and find some information, but that's a set of words that is new to me. I'm going to turn it back to you, Roy. Drag your feet in case there are people on frequency who have heard about the polyscope and can tell us about it. AC2GS to take it with some delay. KQRIW in the TechNet.
K2J, I've got it, but it's in German.
Okay. You're good at interpreting German. Oh, what do you think it's saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, it's a device that came out in 1961. It uses a lot of tubes. It says, in German, the frequencies are between 400 and 1200 megahertz, the UHF oscillator. Let me do a translate on this. Give me a second.
I actually pulled up the document in English.
Go ahead.
It seems to be a sweep generator from what I can figure out. It mentions a whole bunch of possible feature options. It says measuring header, demodulator, logic probe, RF insertion unit, demodulator probe, active demodulator. It offers amplifier plugins, a logarithmic amplifier, a linear amplifier, a logarithmic, another logarithmic amplifier with digital display. It has a whole bunch of features, so it's probably a kind of a poly tool, if you will.
Back in the old days, we used to take a sweep generator, directional coupler, go through a calibration procedure, and then sweep the frequency across a device under test and look at the throughput signals and look at reflected signals. You take all of those individual pieces of equipment and combine them into one box. Nowadays, it's called a vector network analyzer. A vector network analyzer is a sweep oscillator, and it detects how strong is the signal that flows through the device of the test, how strong is the signal reflecting off the front end of the signal of the device of the test, and the vector network analyzer not only measures amplitude of those signals, but measures the phase angle of those signals. You put it all together, and you're measuring input vector and output vector, and there's all kinds of ways you can display that. So I am guessing that this polyscope is the early version of what became a vector network analyzer. That's what I think. Let's see if Eric agrees with that. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I just got it in English now. It's an SWOB5. And it looks like, as Roy said, it looks like a sweep generator with an oscillator, a sweep generator, got a logarithmic amplifier, a linear amplifier, it's got markers. Oh, here we go. Any configuration of display section from a single channel linear to two channel logarithmic channels from its simultaneous display of transmission characteristics and reflection, pulse or vertical line frequency markers, brightening, manual brightening, separate RF insertion units. Looks like a real fancy sweep generator. It's got a slow sweep option, an external control option, IF markers, oscillators at 33.4 and 38.9. What else? It's got an IEC bus interface. the modulator probe. Yeah, it looks like a sweep generator more than anything else. Yeah, the Polyscope SWOV-5 combines in a compact unit all the measuring facilities needed for an up-to-date sweep test. Let me make a drop.
And up-to-date, was that 1961 vintage? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, sweep generator output, EMF of 1 volt with plus 6 dB. Got an output attenuator. Different amplifier combinations are possible. Use it in laboratory, high dynamic range, wide sweep width from 0 to 1,000 megahertz. It produces CW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we lost the last 30 seconds of that, Eric, but because of timeout. Somewhere around 1970 or so, Hewlett-Packard started coming out with vector network analyzers. The modern-day vector network analyzer was its built-in frequency synthesizer, because the frequency is known by way of the synthesizer. You don't need markers anymore. You don't have to have separate detectors for input signal flowing through or flowing back out. You can make the display logarithmic or linear. You can make the display XY or polar, and so on. So it looks to me like this is an early development in the direction that eventually became a vector network analyzer. Modern-day vector network analyzer. It's got a zillion ways of testing a device on the test, a zillion ways of displaying the data any way you want. Linear, logarithmic, square law, XY, polar, and so on. So if somebody gave you a Polyscope free of charge and you want to restore it to operating condition, let me drop.
This thing's definitely a sweep generator. And you can plug the results into an XY recorder.
But the XY recorder is built into a vector network analyzer. The sweep generator is built. See, a modern-day vector network analyzer does all of these things. So nobody today, in my opinion, would buy a Polyscope. Restore one for historic reasons, yes. But a modern-day VNA does all of these things for you. In fact, there's very few things it doesn't do. A modern-day vector network analyzer, if you set it up correctly, you can have it sweep the frequency and sweep the amplitude sequentially or simultaneously, so you can actually measure linearity characteristics of a saturatable device under test. Not very many people know that, but built into it is the capability of sweeping amplitude as well as sweeping frequency. Anybody want to add any comments or questions to all of the above, give me your call letters right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
This thing's a bit like a spectrum analyzer with a tracking generator. Actually, when I used to work on cable in the 70s, which would be a wonderful device.
To SAY.
Haven't heard from Doug in a long time. W-A-2-S-A-Y. Go right ahead, Doug.
No, it's been a while. I usually am at supper, and I've just finished supper. Anyway, I was going to comment that there are now a couple of very cool VNAs which operate with a computer for, I guess, somewhere under $1,000, little modules that plug into a computer, a Windows computer, and some of them are S11 only, or some of them are also two-port units, which will do S21 and S11 and so on. I don't know. I think there was a review of one of these, at least, QST, in the past year.
I believe there are a number of these modules you add to a computer, which it's a little black box that, by way of the computer doing all the controlling and displaying, really gives you a vector network analyzer function. And yes, some of them are a lot less expensive. A full-blown laboratory separate piece of equipment called vector network analyzer that went to, let's say, 8 or 16 gigahertz, you can easily spend tens of thousands of dollars for that nowadays, whereas these little black boxes you add to your computer, you can get most of those functions for much, much cheaper prices. That's what I think you're bringing to our attention at this time, Doug. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-A-W. I bet you there's more than one brand name that was available now.
I think you're correct, Dick. I'm pretty sure there is at least two brand names, and I don't know off the top of my head what they are, but I remember seeing these things in, I'm pretty sure one of them at least was in QSD, and at least I think both of them at one different time, at different times, were in microwaves and RF. So, yes, they do exist, and I think, as I say, I'm pretty sure at least one of them is under $1,000. Probably both of them, either or both, are under $2,000 or $3,000 at least. Even that's a lot of money for a ham, just to screw around with the antennas, but it would be worthwhile looking into that, I think, if anybody really is interested in doing that sort of thing. W-A-2-S-A-Y, back to Ned.
For a person who wants to make HF, VHF, and UHF and microwave measurements on a piece of equipment, the first time you get acquainted, you get exposed to a vector network analyzer, it seems kind of complicated. What of all these crazy things it measures, S11, S12, S21, S22, and what does it all mean? At first, it's a bit overwhelming. However, in my opinion, in the 21st century, it is probably worth the investment to learn what is and how to use a vector network analyzer. Of all the kinds of automatic test equipment that you can learn about, putting some effort into learning what that can do and what it all means is worth it, because modern day measurements, that can save you a tremendous amount of time. Those measurements, let me drop. Arguably the most valuable two graphs in the world. If you are an antenna designer, the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can now find in multiple places of amateurradio.tv and LimarkTechNet.com and so on. You can get the Brown and Woodward curves, where if you know the diameter of the wire, the length of the wire, whether it be a dipole or a monopole, you can predict the exact performance. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward made those measurements the hard way with a slotted line, a frequency measuring device, a signal generator, and so on. They probably spent a good fraction of a man year making those measurements to give you those curves. Very valuable pieces of information. With a modern-day vector network analyzer, you could measure all of that data in a day instead of a year. It'll save you that much time and give you even greater accuracy and fancier displays, if you know what I mean. So we've come a long way in the way we do that kind of measurements. K2RIW listening for anybody with any further questions or comments. Go right ahead, Eric.
The VNA was a thing called a mini VNA, and it sells for $4.99. It goes from 1 megahertz to 2.2 gigs, the new one anyway. The one that I have only goes to 1.5, but it's a tiny little thing. I put it up against my Rhodes and Schwartz, and it's pretty damn close. It doesn't have all the nice math functions and everything else that you get out of the RNS, but it's good enough for any ham, that's for sure. And it's cheap. Actually, Tektronix is, they're kind of winding down making VNAs with displays on them. They have a box. Actually, they went into competition. Same thing with Agilent or Keysight. They went into competition with a company called Copper Mountain that makes a VNA that beats the pants off of both the Agilent and the Tektronix, but they're catching up.
The mini VNA, who manufactures that and where are they located? Is that Long Island company, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, if you go back about I think it's about 6 years or 7 years in QEX, there's a an article of a single board VNA, and that was actually done by the two guys in Germany, and they turned it into a company in it. And the nice thing about this is if you happen to be working on a dipole, and you don't really want to connect to the cable, you want to connect right to the balun at the bottom of the antenna that might be 20 feet up. You hook this little thing up to it. It's got a battery in it, and it transmits its results via Bluetooth. So it's come a long way. Yeah, this originated in Germany, and it's distributed by a number of different places.
Sounds like a rather nice piece of test equipment. So, once again, don't be afraid of Vector Network Analyzer. When you first get exposed to it, it's formidable. But if you make the investment, you'll be using it for the rest of your life. Those functions, that theory of operation, and the hardware itself, you'll be using it a lot. If you make measurements of amplifiers, detectors, antennas, receivers, you can evaluate the dynamic range of a receiver. A vector network analyzer to test the output of a transmitter, there it's a bit incompatible. But I bet you there's ways you can adapt things and still even get that kind of a function. And there's ways you can make it act as a service monitor. I think it's time we go over to the science talk. So, Dr. Roy, AC2GS, go right ahead with your equipment, your portion. You got it, Roy, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. I want to tell everyone that I do every week, if there is any kind of topic you want covered, any questions you need answered, any remarks I made that you wish to dispute, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All the things that I mentioned, there will be links available on a page. You just bring up your browser and type in roy.ac2gs.com, and it will give you a list. There's already a few things that are new, and when I finish this, I will hit the publish, and all the articles will be available. And in addition, there is a chat room, if you're so inclined. That's at chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. Okay, this week, if I can, I would like to recommend the latest September issue of Scientific American. This issue is all about something that should interest most people here, humans. Yes, we all love reading about ourselves and what makes us tick. And they throw in a quote from Shakespeare, too, so consider taking a look at this issue. One of the things brought up in this issue, and something that I have spoken about before, is how evolution uses all kinds of tricks to cut corners and appear to obtain results above the physical limitations of our biological wiring. Long before humanity was designing lossy compression algorithms, the force of evolution was discovering and implementing these bioengineering hacks unconsciously. Let me drop. Part of these bioengineering hacks include the shortcuts of our own mind to come to its conclusions. Even we don't have the necessary processing power to crunch all the numbers perceptible in our environment. We throw a lot of data away, and we simplify a lot of our inputs unconsciously. Now, one of my favorites is called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Wikipedia is rather polite in this, in defining it as a failure to adequately assess their level of competence or their incompetence at a task and thus consider themselves much more competent than anyone else. Less polite definers have sometimes described this as people who are too stupid to know how stupid they are. Now, it happens to all of us. We all know nothing about a given subject that we realize, and we ask someone who actually knows something about it. But there's always a point at which we know just enough about something to give us a full sense of security that we have conquered a relatively complicated subject. Let me drop. Now, I recently discovered an interesting YouTube channel that's more informational regarding something like Dunning-Kruger effect than it is about its stated subject. There's an English gentleman who apparently has dedicated a significant portion of his life refuting the erroneous conclusions of flat earth enthusiasts in their repeated attempts to simply disprove heliocentrism with gravity, using beach balls, protractors, and United Nations flags. And there seems to be two flat earth camps. One is a group with a slight religious bent. You often hear them talking about the firmament and sacred texts. The other is globally, or in their case, flatly interested in conspiracy theories involving aliens, although I'm not sure how these aliens fit into the small, flat universe. I find it interesting to hear guys trying to explain things that they obviously don't have the faintest idea and don't want to look up. And if it's of interest to any of you guys, I've put links both to the Dunning-Kruger effect and the examples in the YouTubes of this guy refuting strange things about gravity. It's listed on roy.ac2gs for your interest. Let me drop. Now, Paul has spoken before about the planetary dust storms that have covered Mars for months now. NASA's 15-year-old rover Opportunity has been taking a bit of a dirt nap June 10th, unfortunately. Without visibility for its solar cells to charge it, Opportunity has been short on opportunities to signal that it's still alive. Opportunity's sibling, the rover Curiosity, is a nuclear-powered device rather than solar-powered, so the dust storm is less of a problem for Curiosity. The NASA press release explains that dust storms are measured with a number called tau, with a higher tau indicating a more opaque atmosphere. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, a satellite that circles the planet, can estimate the tau by observing the surface. The rover needs a tau no higher than 2 in order to charge its batteries. Normally, its environment's tau is 0.5, and during the storm, it was as high as 10.8. At present, the tau is somewhere between 2.1 and 2.5, according to the Opportunity team. So they don't expect to hear from it anytime soon. Let me drop.
I'm going to guess that tau is the ratio of the signal that goes through the atmosphere versus the perfect clarity. So a tau of 8, does that mean only 1/8 of the signal gets through the atmosphere? Over to you, Roy.
No, if it's a linear scale or an exponential scale. So I didn't look it up.
Okay, but the tau closer to zero is desirable, and the high numbers are undesirable. Is that true?
WS2N, he clipped out at a certain number, Dick, 0.5.
Below 0.5, everything is peachy keen. It's 2.1, it's somewhere between 2.1 and 2.5.
So Curiosity is, on its nuclear power supply, is doing very well. But the little rovers that work on solar cells, right now they're not getting very much charging, is what I think you're saying, Roy. Is that true?
Indeed, it's incommunicado. I have a little bit more on it, though. Test itself in the event of error. The Opportunity has an automatic safe mode types of behaviors called the fault conditions. Just expect that the rover has gone through low power, through mission clock, and possibly even what they call uploss. Fault conditions, according to the newest Opportunity update. Low power faults make the rover hibernate. Clock faults tell the rover to rely on things other than its internal clock to make decisions. And uploss faults tell it that its normal communication systems aren't properly functioning. Meanwhile, NASA engineers are pinging Opportunity, hoping to hear a response back. After that first response, it will take a few weeks to gather information about the rover's current state and determine what kinds of damage it might have suffered. Now, when NASA uses the term pinging, they aren't alerting sonar tone transmitted in the ether waiting for a sonar-like echo back. No, NASA is using a playlist of selected songs transmitted to Opportunity's receiver to kick it back to response mode. Some of the songs appear to have been chosen with the engineers firmly placed with their tongue in their cheek. To name just a few, they are going to try and wake up Opportunity, which the golden oldies as Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, Dust in the Wind, Here Comes the Sun, Rocket Man, Life on Mars, and I Will Survive. Who says engineers don't have a sense of humor? Let me drop for any questions or comments.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
They said this is the worst dust storm that they've ever had since they've been looking at Mars with telescopes. So the engineering that they did all these years ago is paying off. That thing landed in January 2004. So here, you know, over 14 years later, and it's still doing very well. I'm just wondering if they expect the clock to actually go down to zero. I know that was a possibility a couple of months ago. It would just die altogether, and then when the dust clears, it'll actually start recharging. But it won't know what time of day it is because the clock won't be running. And I know they have a certain way of going about trying to get that reset. Also, the transmissions, I believe, are direct. You know, it won't be pointing at the Mars, MRO up above orbiting the planet. So it's direct to Earth, isn't that right?
This is a direct transmission, and apparently the method that they came up was to broadcast audio on a channel and program Curiosity to kind of listen into the receiver when it first wakes up, even though it doesn't know what time of day it is. And they're waiting for a playlist, apparently.
Paul, roughly how long does a dust storm typically last on Mars? There's probably a big variable there. Over to you on that one, Paul.
Well, this is the biggest. It looks like it's going for a couple of months. June 10th, I think Roy said June 10th, it was down to a tau 10, so 10.5. So it was before that. So I think the end of May it started. So that's what, end of June, and just, I guess this is going to be a 3-month or better storm overall, which is the longest that they've seen since we've been looking at the planet. And I know that tau, you know, tau is it's actually an astronomy number. Tau is used for a lot of things, but in physics and in biology and everything. But in astronomy, that's how much light gets through. So 0.5, that's practically nothing. Okay, back to you. Who was it? Dick, you asked a question.
Roy, you got it.
Okay, very good. Approximately every 5.5 Earth years is a storm of some kind, but I think as far as people have been looking at it, this is a real whopper.
I wonder what changes in 5 years to make the storm recycle. It doesn't sound like it's related to the sunspot cycle. Over to you, Roy.
No, it isn't. It's basically, they also describe it as approximately every 3 Mars years. So it's not where they are in space, because they're there 3 times before it happens again. It's unfortunately probably a very, very complex interaction of a bunch of variables, most of which we're not even aware of yet. So it's yet another thing that someone has to really work hard and come up with some great ideas of what different things are all adding up together and giving us these enormous storms.
So there are people who are looking forward to what they think is going to be colonization of Mars. of all the things they consider, living through a dust storm is something I'll bet you they never even considered. Back to you, Roy.
Thanks. So I think a lot of these guys don't read the bad news. They only read the good news, and I guess humanity requires a certain number of romantics. If you do the math on the moon, that sounds like a terrible place to vacation, but I'm glad the astronauts went there. I don't understand the need to park yourself there permanently. I don't think storing up helium-3 is going to be that much of a moneymaker, so I think we're romanticizing a bit, but it's understandable.
WHSCDL, I got to make a comment.
Yeah, sure. Comment away.
Yeah, Roy, I'm just letting you know, I'm listening to you, and you, for some reason, it seems like your frequency is drifting. You are dropping out on voice peaks, besides the other dropouts that you've had, and you are distorted. You don't sound clean to me.
It sounds quite clean to me, Andy. So you and I are hearing him differently.
If you listen closely, you can hear it. It's not bad, but I noticed it. I'm just letting Roy know. Just wanted to let you know that.
I needed to pour out. It's not quite that bad. I'm only pouring out 55, but still, it's a lot more than I usually need.
Yeah, and some nights you do need it because the propagation changes. You were dead full quieting an hour before the TechNet, and I know you've had to run high power during this TechNet in order to have good input. So that pass between you and Glen Oaks, I guess it's not a direct line of sight, and it is dependent on local weather conditions, is a guess on my part. Can you do it, Jack?
I think it could be multi-pass.
I see what Eric's going to say. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, earlier in the week we tried having him switch antennas, and the antenna's not exactly in the same place, so we still ran into the issue, although it was less of an issue, it happened less often, but as far as frequency goes, that was going to be my next thing. So, Andy, can you hear him on the service monitor, and can you watch what's going on?
No, I can't. I'm in the car, number one. I don't hear him on the input. And even if I'm home, my antenna's down right now. So I'm just mentioning what I detect. And I know what Roy sounds like, and I know what he sounded like in the past. And I do hear some distortion of some type. It could be multipass, but I'm not sure. All right, back to Dick.
One more thing. His signal strength is right now is just about the same signal strength as Dick has, as far as the repeater's receiver is concerned.
Andy, if you're not hearing Roy on the input, how do you know his uplink frequency is drifting?
I don't per se, but I do hear the distortion on voice peaks, which I did not hear before. And if you listen to his audio, it sounds like he's off frequency a bit. If you got to listen closely, it's not. You have to have a good ear for it, and it's because it's not bad. It's hard to. You're just gonna have to notice it over time.
The high power RF you're running now, Roy, is doing a beautiful job. Maybe you should back off on your audio into the mic by half a dB, just to be on the safe side, to not over deviate. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, how's this? Is this...
Sounds good to me.
Very good. We'll move on to the next item, the giant Magellan telescope. It's going to be big. It's going to be really big. 83.5 feet in diameter, high up in the Chilean desert. It's one of several gigantic telescopes under construction. It could help researchers look at distant galaxies as well as exoplanets. The telescope consists of 7 28-foot mirrors arranged in a honeycomb shape atop a concrete platform inside a 6-foot-tall enclosure. It's located 8,248 feet up in the Atacama Desert, known for its placid, dark, and clear skies. Construction will require digging out 23 feet of solid rock in order to place the concrete. The telescope's first light is expected in 2024. The giant Magellan telescope will observe optical and infrared wavelengths of light and will be equipped with a special adaptive optic to remove the blurring caused by the atmosphere. This will allow it to view details in the far distance, like galaxies from the first billion years of the universe's existence. It should also help scientists directly image exoplanets surrounding other stars and determine the kind of molecules in their atmospheres. Let me drop. Though the giant Magellan telescope will have resolution better than the Hubble Space Telescope, there is a trade-off between being on the ground and being outside of the Earth's atmosphere. From the ground, you should be able to observe closer to the stars, but will probably be limited to moderate planet-to-star brightness ratios. A scientist involved in this project remarked, "From space, you can't get as close to the star because of the smaller telescope diameters, but you should be able to observe much fainter planets." What that boils down to is that these gigantic telescopes will be better for observing exoplanets around M-dwarf stars. Space telescopes equipped with starlight-blocking coronagraphs could better observe planets around sun-like stars. Both important candidates for extraterrestrial life. Let me drop. Scientists from around the world will write proposals reviewed by a selection committee in order to reserve telescope time. The telescope's founders include a consortium of universities, and funding will come from countries around the world, including South Korea, Australia, Brazil, and as well as the National Science Foundation and other agencies. The telescope is just one of a host of extremely large telescopes on the horizon, including the controversial telescope planned for Hawaii and the extremely large telescope the European Southern Observatory is planning for Chile. Bigger is when it comes to looking at space, and telescopes are entering an era where they become truly enormous. Who knows what else they're going to discover in the universe? Let me drop for any questions or comments.
We heard you, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, when you hear his audio drop out, I see the RF level drop. So, that's a clue. Why, I couldn't tell you.
What I think you're saying is your remote input. You're looking at the output of the remote input and you see a dropout. Are you literally seeing his RF input and seeing a dropout of his RF input, Eric? Go ahead.
I am looking at the repeater's receiver's actual RF level, and I'm seeing it drop. When you get that little dropout, there's a bit of a dip in the RF, although the sample rate I'm using is a little slow. So if it really drops out all the way to zero, I couldn't tell you. If I increase the sample rate, I could probably find out.
Okay, so you're looking at the IF of the remote receiver, of the voting system, so to speak.
Negative. I am looking at the Glen Oaks receiver, not the voting system.
I accept that. Okay. But until we hear his RF signal directly before it goes into the repeater, we can't be absolutely sure what's going on here as I see it, Eric. Maybe I'm being overly conservative.
What I am seeing is the RF going through the front end, making it to the first input stage of the IF of the receiver. And I'm looking at, if you want to call it the ADC level or the RSSI, that's where I'm seeing it. I'm not actually monitoring 146.25 RF-wise, but I am looking at the down-converted output that's actually in the repeater at 12.8 megahertz.
and those periodic dropouts are a little bit difficult to explain. A burst of RF that would create a desensitization could do it, but it should be happening on my signal at the same time, because at Glen Oaks, aren't I going into the exact same input channel?
Yes, and his signal strength, actually my signal strength is a little bit stronger than yours, and his signal strength is almost exactly the same level as yours.
So it's a mystery, but the dropout that we hear on your audio, Roy, is for, let me pick a number, a quarter of a second, a half a second, and it happens once every 10 seconds, I'm guessing. So it's something we notice, but we get 99% of what you're saying. You got it, Roy.
Okay, so in the end, my dropout is more mysterious than most of the science topics that I picked to discuss. That's a curious happenstance.
It's random. It's not every 10 seconds. You can go for 2 or 3 minutes and not a thing happens.
It's mysterious. And yes, another science project for us to investigate, Roy.
Okay, here's one where they actually solved it. The scientists have spent a lot of time breaking dry spaghetti noodles, more than you would think. There's a long history of studying how things break into pieces. This Richard Feynman that we've mentioned a bunch of times famously tested how dry spaghetti snapped when he brought its ends together. Almost always, it would snap into 3 or more pieces. Now, researchers have actually been revisiting this experiment and have noticed that by adding a twist, they could stop the dry pasta from flying all over the place. The secret is that you have to twist it a fair amount. The energy from the fracture gets divided into the twist, according to an MIT doctoral student involved in this report. Researchers snapped perhaps 350 pieces of spaghetti and filmed the results with a high-speed camera that could capture up to 1 million frames per second. The pasta fragmentation had several stages, beginning with a first fracture, followed by catastrophic failure, and then waves traveling down the noodle. The recoiling waves led to the secondary break and the noodle bits flying everywhere. But by adding a twist larger than 250 degrees, they greatly increased the chance of cracking the spaghetti strand only in half, according to the paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Let me drop for a sec. Beyond pasta physics, the research could lead to a new way of using twists to prevent fractures in a wide range of rod-like materials, including multi-fiber structures and nanotubes. It could also help scientists to gain a better understanding of the natural structures, such as microtubules, cells. Asked if the researchers had tried their experiment with other types of pasta, one responded, "Linguini is planned for the future." Let me drop for any questions or comments.
When you snap a piece of spaghetti, a dry piece of spaghetti, I am guessing you initiate a very drastic shock wave that travels down the spaghetti and then reflects off of the end that you're applying the pressure. I am guessing that if the right kind of a damping structure was connected to each of the ends of the spaghetti before you snap it, I bet you they would get very different results. And that might be easier than twisting. To create that twist in a piece of spaghetti strikes me as a relatively difficult thing to do in the real world, whereas properly mounting it into a damping structure might be a bit easier. Doesn't sound like they pursued damping structures very far. Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
No, I would assume that they would have some significant problems if they applied all their efforts to the endpoints of the spaghetti, because there's a lot of strain and shock waves occurring just at the center point of the bent spaghetti. So there's a great deal of force locally. By the time it dissipates out to the edge of the spaghetti, I would assume you cooked your goose. So I don't know for a fact if they tried any other experiments, although I have read where they repeatedly